Good day again, everyone. As we head into autumn in the Northern Hemisphere, there is worldwide concern that the flu season may bring something much more dangerous than usual. I'm talking, of course, about avian flu and the possibility that it could cross over and cause a human pandemic that could rival the global pandemic of 1918 and 1919, which killed at least 20 to 50 million people, and by some estimates, as many as 100 million people worldwide. A pandemic, I should say, is just a fancy word for a very big epidemic, one that spreads over a wider area, generally across regional and national boundaries. To talk about this crucial topic, I'm very pleased to welcome to the journal microphone Dr. Joseph Contra of Infection Specialists of Lancaster. I'm very happy to have Joe with us today, having worked with him as a colleague since he came to Lancaster and having personally benefited from his outstanding clinical judgment and wise counsel. Joe has spent his adult life in the Mid-Atlantic. After college at Shippensburg University, he went to medical school at the University of Pittsburgh, followed by an internship and residency in internal medicine at the Medical College of Virginia in Richmond. He then had a fellowship in infectious disease and another in medical microbiology, both at the Hospital of the University of Pennsylvania. With that superb background, we are very fortunate that he chose to come to Lancaster to practice in 1987, where he is now a member of Infection Specialists of Lancaster with Drs. Neil Green and Deborah Riley. Joe, welcome to the journal microphone.
Thank you, Larry. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, let me start by asking you, how serious is this threat of an avian flu pandemic?
Well, we can break that down into two questions, I think. A pandemic certainly will recur, as it has historically been the case throughout human history, if that pandemic is due to the H5N1 avian influenza virus currently circulating in Eurasia. It could be one of the most significant microbial events in human history, rivaling the 1918 Spanish flu pandemic.
Well, what's so special about this H5N1 virus?
Typically, avian influenza viruses, when they surface, tend to be of relatively low virulence, limited spread, and tend to come and go as evolution weeds them out. H5N1 has been particularly tenacious and persistent. It first appeared in 1997 in Southeast Asia and China and Hong Kong, where there were a modest number of cases, 18 cases with 6 fatalities. It then disappeared up until 2003, when it reappeared in 8 Southeast Asian nations. And since that time has had an extensive and unprecedented spread throughout Eurasia with quite a bit larger number of human cases.
Now, these human cases, I presume, are occurring principally, or I should say, as I understand it, they're occurring principally in people who are directly exposed to birds that they then contract the disease from. Is that correct, or has human-to-human transmission occurred?
To this point, the major mode of transmission of H5N1 to humans has been from direct contact with infected poultry. To some extent, the droppings of poultry and contaminated objects associated with them, including feathers and other things that may be transported and bought and sold, have been associated with transmission as well. To date, there have been very few cases of human-to-human transmission, although they are beginning to appear, and there was a recent cluster of cases in northern Sumatra where a family of 7 individuals became ill after exposure to an index case without any exposure to other birds or bird products. This, however, fortunately is very limited, and the major mode of transmission to date has been contact with contaminated poultry.
So then what is it that's so frightening about this agent if human-to-human transmission has not thus far been a problem?
Well, I think it's the potential of the virus. This is a very highly virulent virus, and if one compares it to the 1918 Spanish influenza virus, there are a number of very haunting similarities. These include the genomic structure, and the virulence both in terms of animals, birds, and in vitro studies. For example, if you look at human bronchial cell culture infection with H5N1, the number of virions that are produced after an infection cycle are about 39,000 higher fold than with standard influenza viruses. In addition, in animal models, it's been shown that the H5N1 induces what we could call a cytokine storm, very similar to what occurs in patients with septic shock. And this probably plays a role in the very highly pathogenic nature of this virus, with high mortality in infected humans and poultry.
I should have perhaps asked you this earlier, but I'll ask you now. How are these viruses named? We just rattle off H5N1 and it does sort of roll off the tongue, but what do the components of that label come from?
The all influenza ultimately has its reservoir in avian species. There are 16 hemagglutinin subcomponents and 9 neuraminidase subcomponents, and so there are quite a few potential combinations. However, there tend to be relatively few that survive in ascendancy to become epidemiologically significant. The hemagglutinin is the moiety which attaches to the epithelial cell in the respiratory tract and allows entry of the virus.
And that's the H.
That's the H part. The neuraminidase, or the N part, is very important in budding of progeny virus after the cell cycle has been completed. And so both of those are critical to maintaining the life cycle of the influenza virus. Since 1977, there have been several strains which have been circulating in human populations. One is the H3N2 virus, and the other is an H1N1 virus. And these have been components of all of the recent influenza vaccines, and they seem to have established transmissibility among humans, such is not the case thus far for H5 virus.
But I understand that the H5N1 has already gotten into other mammalian species. In other words, it's not just confined to poultry and then the odd human case of, but it has gotten into mammals, other mammals as well.
That's true. If you look at the H5N1 virus that was isolated in 2003 when the latest spread began, and compare it to those strains isolated more recently, 2005-2006, what you find is that there continues to be what's referred to as antigenic drift in the hemagglutinin, meaning that the viruses are not antigenically equivalent. It is the case that these viruses can infect a number of mammal species, and one of the other progressive evolutionary steps has been to do just that. There have been well-documented outbreaks, for example, in Thailand in zoos among tigers and leopards. In Europe, domesticated cats have been involved, and other animal species as well, of course, swine being a common one.
So I guess I would conclude from the things you've said so far that it seems only a matter of time until this virus undergoes enough of a transformation that it will start infecting larger numbers of humans and could potentially also mutate into a form that transmits human to human.
That's the great fear, and I think that the persistence of this virus over several years now has established it as by far the leading candidate among all of the avian flu viruses for the next pandemic for those exact reasons.
Now, in the human cases that we know of, what has the mortality been?
Well, to date, as of July 4th, I should say, there have been 229 cases of avian influenza reported with 131 deaths, which is a mortality rate of about 57%. I would point out that many of these cases are diagnosed relatively late in the illness, and antiviral therapy is usually started late, if at all, so that those things may obviously affect those numbers. But in the human cases, there certainly is a substantial mortality with this virus, which is of great concern.
All right. So we've established the fact that this is a bad actor, that it has the potential to develop the capacity to infect humans in a form that could be transmitted from human to human. And that brings us down then to the next big issue, which is, since we can't change the biologic evolution of the virus, what can we do to protect human beings from this possible pandemic, either by vaccination or, for infected cases, by treatment of people who've already been infected. So first, let me ask you about vaccination, and I'm going to assume that all of the standard flu vaccines that we have obviously are not going to be useful because they are not made to defend against this particular virus. But what about the development of vaccines for the H5N1?
Well, it's true that the standard influenza virus vaccines, including the one that's coming out for the 2006-2007 season, has no antigen in it which would protect against avian flu. However, it's still important as a caveat to be vaccinated because co-infection with circulating human strains and an influenza strain, for example, an avian influenza strain, for example, in a poultry worker, could set up the exact genetic reassortment that's necessary to produce a killer virus, which could easily transmit in humans. So while it's true that the virus vaccine is not protective, it's important that everyone still get one this fall, and
just
particularly healthcare workers.
From a public health standpoint.
The issue of creating a vaccine for H5N1 has been quite problematic. There's a great deal of research ongoing. The nature of the virus creates a number of problems. Influenza vaccine strains are typically grown in chick embryos, and the H5N1 virus is lethal to chick embryos, which creates a huge problem for trying to cultivate the virus. And so reverse genetic engineering has been utilized to produce a number of virus vaccines which are under study. And in fact, this is a huge effort. The U.S. CDC has been following quite a number of vaccine trials, about 30, and the World Health Organization is overseeing 28 international efforts to try and produce a vaccine. Data from all these trials have been will be forthcoming. A few of them have been published, and unfortunately those have been somewhat disappointing.
Doesn't sound very encouraging in terms of vaccine. What about treatment? We do have now antiviral agents for many viral diseases. Of course, when I was in medical school, a viral infection couldn't be treated. It was just, if it was caused by a virus, that was the end of the story. Nowadays, we're accustomed to the fact that we can at least control or greatly modify the course of HIV infection, and everybody's familiar with the fact that that particular entity is no longer something that we can't treat at all. But what about H5N1? Could we use antiviral agents?
Well, as it turns out, the neuraminidase inhibitors, namely oseltamivir, also known as Tamiflu, and zanamivir, also known as Relenza, do have activity against most of the H5N1 viruses that have been cultivated. It's not exclusively the case, however. The older agents, rimantadine and amantadine, which now in the United States are no longer recommended because of resistance in the endemic circulating strains, has been shown in a recent study out of Hong Kong to have some activity against H5N1. So I think the bottom line is that the antiviral susceptibility of this organism, if it evolves into a human strain, will depend on which strain becomes dominant and which strain becomes the pandemic strain. However, there will be some opportunity, I think, to use all four of those agents to some extent. Which one will be the best and which one will be most efficacious in terms of reducing mortality remains to be seen. None of these drugs have really been studied to in a setting of controlling or a nascent outbreak of influenza. And although it's been estimated that these drugs could be useful if deployed in a widespread fashion in terms of quelling a pandemic, that's never really been proven. And the clinical effects of these drugs on clinical cases of influenza is relatively modest. You must start it within a few days of the onset of symptoms, and what you get is a reduction in the degree of in the intensity of symptoms. Whether it'll have a major impact on mortality of a pandemic strain, I think, remains to be seen. But certainly, there's been a great effort to stockpile these drugs around the world, and also Tamiflu has been the one that's been preferred because, at least so far, it seems to have the best activity.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the word stockpile, which leads to my next question. I think by now we're all seasoned enough to know that not every drug that we would like to have available is always available in the amount and at a price that makes sense. So what actually would be the status of supplies of these drugs if indeed there is a global pandemic?
Well, the World Health Organization, Larry, estimated that governmental expenditures to stockpile this drug, oseltamivir we're talking about, have exceeded $3 billion so far. However, the distribution has been somewhat disparate. As you can imagine, countries with less financial resources have less drug, and unfortunately, those are the very countries in which the pandemic is likely to start. In the United States, there's been a stockpiling effort as well, and there's been an estimated 2.3 million treatment courses stockpiled thus far of oseltamivir. Unfortunately, the IDSA, the Infectious Disease Society of America, has estimated that we would need somewhere on the order of 50 to 80 million treatment courses, along with perhaps another 40 million prophylactic courses for even a modest pandemic outbreak. So I think the bottom line is that there's a far insufficient supply of antivirals.
Yeah, and that's just one agent. And you had said that there would probably be some therapeutic advantage in combining several agents.
There might be, exactly. The efficacy of those is probably or will probably be less than that of oseltamivir, but the efficacy will probably not be zero unless a widespread resistance occurs. So there may indeed be a role for other agents to be stockpiled as well, and I think that effort is also underway.
Well, I'm looking for something positive out of all of this, and but before we get to that, is there anything that we ought to be doing or are doing locally?
Well, LGH has been involved with the Pennsylvania Department of Health in establishing a pandemic preparedness plan. And I think this dovetails nicely into something we're working on a few years ago when SARS was a big issue in terms of trying to prepare the hospital and the community for a massive outbreak of a respiratory illness. Although the ability of any given healthcare facility to expand to the extent that might be necessary to handle a huge outbreak is quite limited, I think there have been steps taken here locally to try and prepare for that. In addition, there have been business and public service information sessions, and I think the public has become increasingly savvy about the details of a potential outbreak.
Are you able to offer us anything positive about this whole sad story?
Well, I think the good news is that it hasn't happened yet, and each month and season that goes by in which it doesn't happen gives us additional time to prepare. I think, unfortunately, the state of the situation in general is that eventually this virus will likely be the one to ascend and become the next human pandemic virus. How virulent it will be, what antivirals might be necessary, whether we'll have a candidate vaccine or not by that time are all very open questions. But I think that the more time we have to prepare, the more likely we are to have to minimize the impact of a new pandemic of H5N1.
Because the virus is preparing also.
Yes, the virus is preparing, and that's been one of the problems, actually, particularly in vaccine development. There was a very interesting paper in the New England Journal earlier this year by Treanor in which a Vietnamese strain of H5N1 was used to produce a candidate vaccine. It unfortunately turned out to be not all that immunogenic in humans, but an additional downside was that it was discovered that particular substrain of virus was not the same as substrains in nearby Indonesia. So, for example, if the Indonesian virus happens to be the one to cause the pandemic and we've stockpiled the so-called 1203 vaccine based on the Vietnamese strain, there is no cross-protection at all. So I think it's a matter of vigilance on a worldwide scale. When and if the pandemic begins, that virus will be characterized, and it unfortunately will take probably about 6 to 9 months to produce a vaccine of usable clinically. In the meantime, we'll have to rely on local control measures, antiviral agents being deployed, and a number of other common sense things, social distancing, and other things to try and minimize the impact of an epidemic.
Well, that's not a really encouraging story about vaccine development. Is there a bright side somewhere there?
Yes, actually, I think there are a number of interesting developments in the vaccine world. As you may recall, the original vaccine study that was published in the New England Journal required a fairly high dose of antigen, namely 90 micrograms per dose, to produce what was ultimately a suboptimal immune response. The same manufacturer, Sanofi Pasteur, subsequently published a second study using alum as an adjuvant and was able to reduce the immunogenic dose to 30 micrograms, which is a big step in the right direction. However, recently, GlaxoSmithKline has developed a vaccine using a proprietary adjuvant, which is a quantum leap from the second study and has reduced the immunogenic dose down to 3.8 micrograms. And that's a hugely important piece of information. The vaccine development has to do a great deal with the amount of antigen that can be produced over a period of time. And the lower the immunogenic dose that can be created, the more number of vaccine doses can be made from a given lot of influenza virus. And I think in the future this will be a big push. There are about 60 or so vaccine trials ongoing, funded both in the United States and Europe. And I think as the next 6 months go on, we'll see more and more vaccine trials come out and hopefully better and better results.
Well, since you mentioned that Glaxo trial, as I recall, that the assessment of that vaccine was based entirely on the serum levels of antibodies that the vaccine was able to stimulate. Of course, that doesn't translate into proven clinical effectiveness, does it?
Exactly. The threshold for protection is an a priori determination by the vaccine developers, and we won't know until these vaccines are field tested against actual virus to what extent they are protective. But clearly, the more immunogenic the vaccine is, the more likely we are to have at least some degree of protection or at least amelioration of the disease itself.
Well, the other bright side of the story has been your terrific grasp of this subject and your comprehensive review of a very complicated subject. And I wanted to thank you for coming to share your insights and expertise with us. Thank you very much.
Well, it's been my pleasure to be here, and I hope that the next time we talk about this, it will continue to be in a theoretical fashion.
You know, when we talk about the future, I can't help remembering the comment that Norm Shumway made. Norm Shumway was the head of cardiac surgery at Stanford University and is the father of heart transplantation. And he died recently, which was a great loss. But some years ago, because of the problems that were prevalent with an inadequate supply of donor hearts, he was asked about the potential for heterograft heart transplantation, in other words, taking hearts from animals, perhaps genetically engineered pigs, we would say nowadays, but of course in those days that concept hadn't yet been developed. In any event, Norm Shumway said that heterograft heart transplantation was the future of heart transplantation in humans and always would be. Sort of his cynical way of saying that we're never going to pull it off. Well, I'd like to paraphrase that comment of Norm's and say that I hope that the avian flu virus will be the greatest future threat in infectious diseases, and always will be. Well, that's it for this issue. We hope you've enjoyed these interviews, and as always, we welcome your feedback and encourage you to write, call, or email me or our managing editor, Gina Bissett. You'll find contact information on the contents page of the print journal. Before signing off, I'd like to mention briefly that our next issue, which will appear in December, will be a special one devoted to the topic of vitamin D and calcium, two nutrients that affect the metabolism and function of virtually every organ in the body. I know you will find much that is interesting and relevant in that special issue, and I encourage you to read it carefully. Until then, this is Larry Bonchek thanking you for listening and wishing you all the best until next time.